I'm talking to Mickey Kaus, author, pioneering political blogger, and former California senatorial candidate, and a person I've known for, I guess, about a couple of years now, a little bit. We started talking during the John Edwards scandal a long time ago. How you doing, Mickey?
I'm doing fine, Lee. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. So let's talk about the Edwards thing, because it did occur to me that I want to talk about your senatorial run, some of the ideas behind that, and some of your philosophy. But we did get to know each other during the Edwards scandal a little bit. And I figured, since we're talking, for if nothing else for the historical record, we should probably get some of that stuff out. So what was your background on the Edwards scandal? Because you were really one of the first people to talk about it at all, correct?
Yeah, I actually was for Edwards in 2004. I fell for the blank slate and thought he was a potentially good candidate. And he was running, if you remember, slightly to the, he was sort of a little bit neoliberal, at least he was open to the possibility of not being a doctrinaire Democrat, and I like that. I just happen to know somebody who hangs out with a crowd in New York that knows, that intersects with Riel Hunters and a crowd, and who told me, look, there's this woman who's running around New York saying and practically the second thing she'll tell you if you run into her at a party is, I'm having an affair with a very famous man named John, or words to that effect. And so I just knew it was true. And I said, is this woman trustworthy? And my source said, no, she's not trustworthy, but the other people around her are. And the combination of her saying it and it being confirmed by people who are not as wacky as she is, it's true. So I knew it was true. So as it's always easier to get a story if you know what the answer is.
No, right. I agree. You know, it's interesting too, because you talk about the sort of unreliable source of her. Well, the other, because I ended up getting into the story with the National Enquirer, catching Edwards at the Beverly Hills Hilton.
Right.
And, the National Enquirer, if you'd ask around, is the National Enquirer reliable? people might say no, although I guess my feeling at the time was that they kind of are reliable. You just have to know how to parse them.
You were the first person, and it's weird. I was preparing a list of these data points right when they busted Edwards at the Hilton. My feeling was I never put together all the 20 reasons that Edwards' story made no sense and all the 20 indicia he gave out that he was BSing. And you did. You were the first guy to say, hey, look, this guy's story just doesn't add up. Look at these five things. He's slippery here. He's slippery there. Nobody who was innocent would do this, this, and this. I think you were the first to, after the Hilton to say, hey, listen, Democrats, let's look at this rationally. This guy's story doesn't add up.
Well, no, I was, and I was really freaked out being the only person that I could see saying that, because I felt like I must be wrong. I felt in a sense like, if I'm the only person saying this, there's something wrong here.
Well, it's weird. I don't know quite how that mechanism works. I mean, I know you were sternly disciplined by the Daily Kos, and your posts were taken down, and you were, I don't know, they strip you of your epaulets in a ceremony or something. But that's to be expected, because Kos has been in the Edwards pocket for a long time.
Yeah.
So why didn't anybody else pick up on it? And I would love to see whatever the journalist archives had about Edwards. I don't think journalists was powerful enough to squelch debate, but it'd be interesting to see if they actually tried.
Well, that would be interesting to me too. Now that the revelations about this journalist thing have come out recently, I'd be curious about that too. I mean, I know I talked to some people, like I know Josh Marshall from Talking Points Memo a little
right.
bit, and he wasn't covering it. But I will say to his credit that later when it was looking like a real thing, he referred some of his reporters to me and said, you know, Lee knows this story, and sent people over to talk to me about it. But I think it was later in the game, you know, at that point.
Well, there's this weird, well, Josh is a smart guy and he would know, you know, what the truth is. He would be able to suspect it. There's this weird phenomenon that went on the left of, it's not true, how dare you say this, and then as soon as it was proven, oh, well, we knew that all along. we just discounted it because it wasn't important, really.
I think talking about the Edwards thing also sets the stage for another thing I wanted to talk to you about, was the idea of being a contrarian in the Democratic system. Now, you know, the thing that was surprising to me, even about getting banned from Daily Kos, was I didn't expect that from progressives. If you told me a conservative group had really sort of quelled individual thought in the name of groupthink and really hammered on it, I would have gone, well, sure, because I'm not a conservative, so I'm suspicious of them. But for that to happen with progressives was really, and again, I was, you know, barely, I don't know, and I still am, I guess. I wasn't really a journalist or anything. I was just a guy, and I happened to be writing for the Huffington Post because of comedy videos that I'd done. And with the platform of the Huffington Post, I could write about whatever I wanted to. And so I got a very, it really opened my eyes to the amount of groupthink that exists, not just on the right, but on the left as well. Go ahead.
There's been sort of a sea change, and I realized that when somebody wrote me an anonymous note about journalists, their function was basically, they didn't technically enforce conformity. I mean, that wasn't their stated goal. But in fact, there were stages in which if you went and ventured contrarian opinions, you would be beaten up by the heavyweight guys like, you know, Brad DeLong and Eric Alterman. So it had the effect of, on journalists, you were rewarded for conformity. And that's so, and on Daily Kos, you're rewarded for conformity. And maybe even on the sort of the entire left blogosphere, you're rewarded for conformity. And that's so completely the opposite of the sort of incentive structure when I was, you know, a young journalist. You got attention by being contrarian. And maybe that was a bad incentive system too, but I think it's better because, you know, if enough people are contrarian, you can weigh the various, you know, do what you're supposed to do in a marketplace of ideas and figure out who's right. George Will, for example, made his name by being the conservative who was against Nixon. He was the first to break with Nixon and say, you know, this guy's indefensible. That made his name. You know, similarly, I work for Mike Kinsley at the New Republic and Charlie Peters at the Washington Monthly, and their whole thing was, you know, I'm a Democrat, but the Republicans have a point here. Unlike the Davis-Bacon Act, classic example of the law that says construction projects have to pay union wages, meaning anything the government does is more expensive than the private sector. These people said, look, if you believe in the government doing things, we shouldn't hamstring ourselves by making it twice as expensive for the government to build something as the private sector. That reward structure has sort of been now killed off by the competing pro-conformist reward structure of the sort of left blogosphere and Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias. And although Iglesias is so smart, he, you know, he says what he thinks and is sometimes contrarian. Anyway, but in general, the incentive structure is now to beat down the nail that sticks up.
Well, you know, and I think the incentive structure is still there in the sense that if you're contrarian, if you're not towing the party line, like at Huffington Post, for instance, they've been, you know, the way it works at HuffPost is basically I write stuff and I
I put it up, and then they choose to feature it or not.
Right.
I have no control over that, and I don't deal with anybody. I never talk to anybody. During the Edwards stuff, I talked to Ariana and Sam Stein a little bit, mainly when after I'd interviewed Fred Barron. I talked to Fred Barron for a half hour, and I didn't know what to do with it because basically I just called him out of the blue, and he didn't want to talk, but he kept talking. And he couldn't keep himself from talking. And I just said, because it was true, I said, I'm not a hit guy here. I'm just trying to get to the truth.
Yeah.
I said, I liked Edwards. I said, I agree with his policy. I said, I'm a Democrat. I said, I've worked for Move On. I've worked for Brave New Films. And he kept talking. And so I had this half-hour conversation with the guy where he admitted a lot of things, but didn't admit to a lot of things either.
Right.
And then I didn't know what to do with it because suddenly, I guess, according to the journalist ethic, it's off the record, although he didn't say that.
Yeah.
And then I didn't know what to do, so literally I had no idea what to do. So I'm like,
he doesn't say it; it's on the record.
That's right. Yeah, I was like, I didn't know what to do with it, and so then I was like, I also didn't want to potentially burn him as a, I didn't want to piss him off as a source at that point. But I ended up publishing the stuff pretty quickly anyway. But anyway, I called Sam Stein and Ariana about that.
My experience is that Ariana, you get your day in the sun on the homepage, but the time that you spend in the sun on the homepage is very variable.
Yes.
And in I think if you write something that pisses them off, you spend a very brief time on the homepage.
Well, they were always very supportive in the Edwards stuff. They were always very nice and supportive.
Ariana started the ball rolling on the Edwards stuff. I mean, the first piece that sort of brought it into light was Sam Stein's piece about how hard it was to get to watch Riel Hunter's videos. How you had to be accompanied by a campaign aide, and in fact, a very high campaign aide, Jonathan Prince, and a lot of Washington—I didn't know this till later—but Washington insiders read that and saw that you had to be accompanied by Jonathan Prince to watch these videos, and they immediately concluded it was true, because if it wasn't true, you wouldn't send Jonathan Prince to accompany a reporter watching some meaningless videos. You would send some low-level flunky, and he was a top aide. So Stein's piece was, in retrospect, you know, extremely instrumental and sort of brilliant in sort of poking the story out into the open.
Well, yeah, but that was the other thing too, why I thought it was so weird that I got the hammer. But since then, you know, I've learned some. Now personally, do you think of yourself, like, you get up in the morning and think, well, how will I be contrarian today?
No, I just sort of read the web until I come across some BS, and then I attack the BS. That's sort of how I see it. And I do have a much more sensitive, you know, I expect the Republicans to BS. So I don't really waste a lot of energy attacking them. And there are plenty of people who are attacking the Republican BS.
Right.
But there are not that many people who are attacking the Democratic BS, so that's sort of my specialized niche. When I decided to run for office, I obviously had to reconnect with Democratic truths and try to the best I could, which is not very well, bring myself to actually say the things that the big things that the Democrats say that are right. So that's a different role. But even then, I was a contrarian candidate, so I was basically running to point out the things in the party orthodoxy that I thought were crazy.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I get this, and I'm sure you get a lot. Now, do you get attacked a lot, or still, or if people just are they used to you?
Well, you know, I have Google Alerts, so it tells me every time my name is mentioned. So I'm still attacked, and sort of, I'm attacked in sort of dismissive, nasty ways by a few bloggers, but I think they basically. I'm not that interesting to them anymore. There was a period when they really went after me, and then they just sort of lost interest. because I wasn't, you know, there was no hope of, I wasn't important enough for them to attack anymore, I guess. So it's about, you know, it's about a fifth of the opprobrium that I got when I was starting out.
Well, the one of the typical attacks, I'm guessing, is that you're really a Republican, or be a Republican, or go to the teabag movement.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I think it's crazy, but it is. There is a certain, you know, in California, there's one sense in which it may be true. In California, the unions are. One of my planks was that the institutional power of labor unions was too great, both in the public sector and in the private sector, in the sense that even though unions are weak, we don't want to increase their institutional power. And the unions sort of own the Democratic Party at the state level in a way that they don't at the national level. So, I would give this talk to people at fundraisers. These aren't people who were committed supporters, but it was a meet and greet. They're potential supporters. And I would say, look, I believe in letting the market economy function as best as possible, which means probably without a lot of union power. And then we have a safety net at the bottom for people who work, a work-based safety net at the bottom, so everybody who works full-time can live a dignity. And that's my vision of liberalism. That's where the government intervenes. And this woman raised her hand and said, look, maybe you're not a Democrat because Democrats, what they mean is we're for union power. That's what it's come to mean. And if you're not for the unions, you're not a Democrat in California, at least. And you're not a Republican, obviously. So you're some sort of weird, you know, independent middle ground. And that may be true in California. I don't think it's true nationally. I don't think the unions, I think you can be a Democrat, a national Democrat, and not be beholden, you know, lockstep. Yes, I want to increase union power. Yes, I'm for this bill to eliminate the secret ballot so unions can get more power. There are a lot of Democrats at the national level who can survive saying that. There's just nobody at the state level.
Well, it also seems like the other issue would be immigration, where you...
Right. That was the hardest sell, bizarrely. My two issues were unions and immigration. When I would attack labor union power, I would get a lot of nodding heads and support, especially when you attack teachers' unions, because anybody who has their kids in public school or is paying through the nose to escape public school knows that the effect that the teachers' unions have on public education isn't good. The amnesty, I got very few nodding heads. It's still like a visceral issue for many Democrats. If you are against amnesty, you must be some kind of anti-Latino racist. And it's bizarre because traditionally the position of Democrats has been we have to protect wages at the bottom. And those are the people who've been, you know, the people who've been screwed in the modern economy the last two decades are unskilled workers. Their wages have lost ground, not just failed to keep pace. The whole thrust of, you know, Clinton's welfare reform and basing a welfare state on work is that if you work, you're going to do okay. But if you work and the only job you can get is paying, you know, $7 an hour, it's very hard for you to do okay. And it's very hard to get a better job if every time an employer, you know, wants to pay $12 an hour, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of undocumented workers ready to work for less. There's no way wages are going to go up. So if you want to protect wages at the bottom, you really have to control the borders. That was my basic argument. And it's, you know, I think eventually it's a winning argument, but maybe not winning within the Democratic Party just because the Latino power of the Latino lobby is so great. And they have flipped too. I mean, Cesar Chavez was against illegal immigration.
Yeah.
There's a venerable left-wing position, including position of many labor unions. You know, we have to control the borders, including many Latino groups. Latinos who've been here since before Anglos and Latinos who came here legally, a lot of them historically have resented newcomers coming and undercutting their wages too, and not going through the hoops. So it's not. an open and shut picture, but I think the ballot, you know, the odds of getting a majority in the Democratic Party are very slim. If you get if you add the 40%, 30% you can get within the Democratic Party to the 80% you can get in the Republican Party and the, you know, 70% you can get as independent, I think you can win the issue in the larger in the larger electorate.
Well, you know, I mean, I think one of the issues, just on a purely visceral level, is that as an intellectual position, opposing amnesty is one thing. On a practical level, for a lot of, let's say, second generation Mexican Americans, so they're, and these are friends, people who I've worked with, whose parents were illegals, let's say,
right?
But they're, but they were born and raised in America, basically, and are effectively, you know, American,
right?
A lack of amnesty means that their parents have to go back, let's say.
And but nobody's deporting their parents. Who's deporting them? They're living in the shadows, and they keep on living in the shadows. It seems to me that's what's going to happen. I mean, we're not going to have immigration reform. So
yeah.
I'm not convinced that that is such a horrible state of affairs. There will be individual cases where, you know, grandma gets stopped by the police and carded, and it's discovered that she's illegal, and there's some move to deport her. But, you know, around the edges, you know, that will happen, and you can sort of be compassionate, and the tendency is to be compassionate. I mean, that's why you don't get deported if you have an anchor baby. It's because nobody deports the parents of an American citizen.
Right.
So that's what happens. As a practical matter, it's sort of the most practical thing in the way, which is we just keep on the way we're doing while we secure the border.
Well, yeah, and I think, too, I mean, I moved out of Southern California. I've lived in California sort of most of the last 20 years, and my dad grew up in California, and I'd been there quite a bit growing up, too, and before I moved there. And I noticed even in Southern California, for instance, if you just go to a like fast food route, like McDonald's, right? It's basically, my experience was everyone behind the counter working at McDonald's was Latino. Everyone was Mexican. When I grew up, it was teenagers working at McDonald's. That's
right.
Who it was. And I didn't see, one thing I noticed, I was living in Burbank, right? One thing I noticed around Burbank was, and I have a son who just turned 18. When I grew up, I worked at McDonald's. I worked at Domino's. That's where I worked when I was 18. Those are good starter jobs. None of my son's friends were looking at working at a fast food place like that. None of them, zero. And part of it is they wouldn't have fit in. I mean, because literally they're not speaking English behind the counter. Everything happening back there is that, I'm not saying everyone who's behind the counter is illegal or anything like that. And I like, one of the things I really liked about LA was the Hispanic culture. I love taco carts and I like that influence. But on the other hand, it's very hard to live in Southern California and not be real aware of how things have changed even in the past 10, 15 years, I think.
No, that's true, the thing I had trouble getting through to people is, you know, everybody who lives in Southern California likes the Latino workforce.
Right. Yes.
They make the place run, you know, much better than it would without them. But and you can say that and still think that we should control the borders, because, you know, while the 12 million who are here may be assimilable, another 12 million and another 12 million and another 12 million, and pretty soon Los Angeles looks like Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
And we don't want that. So you can be for controlling the borders without being anti-Latino, even anti-illegal Latino, and that's a hard message to get across. It requires you it's too complicated somehow. I never found the magic words to you know, that got it across.
Well, I think part of it is really, like, the worst thing you can be now is racist. You know, if you think about, like, the worst thing you can be accused of being is racist. And even having the discussion, so the problem is, if anyone tries to wade into the waters of talking about race at all, it's tricky, because it's easier just to sort of keep your head down and not get into it. And I don't think that the immigration thing's a racial issue, but it brings up race stuff.
It's a racial issue in that the pro-amnesty people have made it a racial issue.
Right.
Because they all say, if you're not for amnesty, you're going to annoy the Latino vote. That makes it a racial issue. And they've consciously made it an issue of racial pride among Latino voters. And both parties are falling over themselves to try to win over Latino voters, specifically on a ethnic pride platform. If you go to pro-immigration reform rallies, and I've been to a couple, it's all ethnic pride. I mean, at the one in L.A., there were some, I think, Asian immigrants. The one in Washington, all Latino. More than half of the rally was conducted in Spanish. It's just all, you know, the basis of, if you know, we have to protect our brothers and sisters of, you know, our co-ethnics. And the problem is, it's very hard for those people then to turn around credibly and say, okay, we're for this amnesty but then that's the last one. Because if we have immigration reform and an amnesty, and another 10 million or 1 million sneak across the border after that, ethnic pride is going to say we have to give them amnesty too.
Yeah.
So if the basis is ethnic pride, there's no way to credibly argue that, hey, you know, just this one amnesty, this is the last one, which is what they're trying to argue. And that's one of the basic issues in immigration reform, is nobody trusts Latino leaders when they say they really want to enforce the border.
Well, and I think also that on the left, you know, anybody who's read a couple of chapters of Howard Zinn knows that indigenous people were kind of screwed over by the white people. Not kind of, were, you know. I mean, and so I think there's that sense as well of like I don't want to call it white guilt, because it's not exactly that. It's sort of awareness. But, and it just becomes a very sticky issue. But if you just look at it, if you just look at it on the facts right now, especially with California's budget crisis, which I made an argument on Huffington Post when I was leaving California a year or so ago, that it's hopeless, that there's no, that the problem in California is you've got the split between the coast and the inland parts of the states, where it's, you know, it's pretty much as Democratic as you're going to get on the coast, and it's like Alabama when you go inland, and that the state is just literally schizophrenic, because you've got the farmers in Fresno who are very different people than the artists and tech workers in San Francisco, and you've got really two states, and I just don't see what's going to save California from that schizophrenia that you can see in the at a state government level.
That's interesting. So they just put the state, but down the middle, down up and down, not north south.
That would be my argument, because really they are. I mean, people in San Francisco, despite they don't want to admit this, but they have a lot more in common with people in L.A. and in San Diego than they do with people in Fresno and Bakersfield, and inland. And really, I mean, inland, you've got and that's what you have in the California State House, I think, is that split. So a Democratic governor, Gray Davis failed, and Schwarzenegger failed. And whoever gets elected next is going to fail, too.
My hope is that if a Democrat gets elected working with the Democratic legislature, they will be accountable. In other words, they have to solve the problem. If they don't solve the problem, it's their fault. in a way that Schwarzenegger and the Democrats, you know, the accountability was split because they could each blame the other.
Yeah.
If they're both in the same party, they got to deal with it. That's the basic reason why for Jerry Brown. I don't think Whitman will be any more successful than Schwarzenegger. So I hold out some hope if Jerry Brown suddenly has a spine transplant, that which is entirely possible, that they'll manage to pull through. So I'm not moving yet.
Yeah, I love California, and I hope it makes it. But New Mexico's nice too, and it's a lot more affordable. And I think the other thing that's happening with the immigration thing is that both you saw this with Bush, and now the Democrats are sort of all in on it. Is they just see it as if amnesty happens, suddenly there's X millions of new voters, and they want to be the beneficiary of those votes. What do you think that's a factor?
Oh, that's a huge factor. That clearly was behind Bush's push for amnesty. Is the Republicans realize that this is a growing vote, and if they lose it, it's not that the Republican Party will be out of power for a generation, because they'll just have to adjust and be more liberal, and they don't want to do that. Bush had this crazy idea that if he was the guy who produced amnesty, he would be like the Abraham Lincoln for undocumented Latinos, and they would be loyal to him and his party, for a long time. And A, that's never going to happen. And B, the loyalty would be to Bush, not to the Republicans. So it was insane. Obviously, Latinos are going to be overwhelmingly Democratic. They come from a country where the politics is way, the center of gravity of politics is way to our left. And the government's expected to do a whole lot more. So it's a pipe dream on the part of Republicans. I don't understand it. It's like something that's cooked up in a Washington think tank, has no relation to reality.
Well, you know what I think it is? I think it's they deal with Cubans. And
very good point.
The people who the Republicans deal with are Cubans who are really strong, who are Republican and very strongly anti-socialism, whatever.
And also, even the immigrants who aren't Cuban have many virtues that Republicans admire. They're pro-family. A lot of them are pro-life.
Yes.
They're religious. They're hardworking. So they're characteristics that Republicans admire and would like to, seize on. But they're still Democrats. I mean, and even the Cubans, a friend of mine points out, even Cubans, if you took away Castro,
right,
they would be left-wing Democrats.
Yeah,
they're not, Castro was the only, and opposition to Castro was the only thing driving them into the Republican Party.
Right. Yeah. I agree. But I think that that's what sort of caused that delusion on the right that they could do it, because they know a few Latinos who seem to like them. And but I agree completely. It's just it's a reaction to Castro. It's not a reaction to health care. It's
right. If you said, "Do you support health care?" The half of the anti-Castro people would say, "Yeah, sure, I support government health care." I mean, anyway, that's so we agree on that. I think Bush, Bush was a little successful with that in Texas, so we figured he could replicate it on a national level, and that's
no right. Yeah, no, I agree completely. Yeah, it's he had some success, and that went to his head. What was your experience? So how did you like running for Senate?
I liked it more it's getting better and better in retrospect. At the time, I was very happy that when the campaign ended, because I was exhausted, and it's a very tense, because you have this hard time limit, you got to get things done immediately, and you have to make a lot of rough and ready decisions that maybe aren't best in retrospect. And you're constantly asking people for things, which is a very uncomfortable position to be in. You're asking for money, you're asking for support, asking for their vote, asking them to help you out as volunteers. It's an exercise in reverse altruism and egomania. And it's just uncomfortable. I love talking to people. That was good.
Yeah.
Even people who opposed me, that was the good part. And making ads and generating propaganda was fun. It's a very hard nut to crack. I mean, I talked to a congressman who said, you know, one of my failings was I didn't really book myself into a lot of colleges where I gave talks to a few hundred people here and there. And I ran into a congressman and said, look, that doesn't do you any good in California. Even if you talk to 3,000 people, which would be a huge meeting, you're only talking to 3,000 people. California has 30 million people.
Yeah.
You have to get play in the mass media. There are some exceptions to that, but that's sort of the only ball game. And I now have a good feel for what the ball game is and the mistakes I made, and mainly not, one of the mistakes was not going into the inland, more conservative areas heavily. Instead, I sort of made a play for LA. But you have to raise money and basically, you know, make a lot of and spend it on mass media, and also try to make a lot of noise and get attention in the free media. And it's the press will not pay attention to you unless they see you getting some traction, and you can't get traction until the press pays attention to you. So you have to somehow solve that problem and slowly get traction and slowly get press attention. And you have to have a better fundraising operation that I have. The web is not going to by itself save you.
Yeah, not now.
By itself save me.
Yeah, I think not. I think not now. But I have one of my pet theories right now is that we're about a decade away from the possibility of a viable third party, even because if you just look at where the trends are going. Right now today when you're running, you still need to do TV. You have to do that. But I think in a decade, I think the whole thing will have shifted over to the internet. Because it's inevitable at some point. Maybe it's 20 years, or maybe it's 4 years.
And your theory is the internet will be cheap enough that you won't need that much money?
Yeah, that the leverage, it's already sort of there. You know, you can see it, I think, now with Obama and with the Tea Party movement. And there's all these little data points that indicate that there's definitely change happening. But when as TV viewership continues to fall, and it's happened really rapidly. I mean, I worked at NBC when I was out in California. And I could see it. I could see the difference in NBC's revenues just working there. Not even looking at the ratings, just looking like the cafeteria is now closed at 3. I think that's obviously the trend that's going to keep happening. And more people get their TV from their phone, let's say, or whatever, and as viral stuff and social media becomes, you got to remember stuff like Twitter is like 3 years old, and YouTube is like 5 years old. So this stuff is barely existing. I think suddenly the leverage that a person or a small group can get is going to exponentially increase in the next few years.
Very, very interesting, because I've, of course, as we talked about, I'm thinking, you know, it's a third party a way to go. Possible complications. One is the Tea Party and Obama are the examples, because Obama sort of raised enough money maybe on the internet that he wasn't beholden to anyone.
Yeah.
But the Obama model is you raise money from a lot of people and then you use it to buy TV ads. So
right.
You're saying the Obama movement could have survived even without TV as the basis of a sort of a web-driven. Well, and I think that's right. Because you had a very, very charismatic person at the top. So a Sarah Palin or a Barack Obama will always be able to generate a sort of web-driven mass movement. And the other sort of mass movement that will be generated is sort of an extreme movement like the Tea Party. So they'll, but in general, the problem is that the web tends to be polarizing. In other words, if you look at the sites that are successful, they're left-wing sites or right-wing sites, not centrist sites. As a centrist blogger, I, you know, feel that every day. So if you want a third party in the center, it's not clear that the web is a congenial medium. Maybe
well,
it is.
Well, here's what I think is missing. What I think is missing is a strong central idea that the third party would be formed around. Even with the Tea Party movement, there's not – it's like I say, to me, the Obama campaign is a data point. The Tea Party thing is a data point. What you see with the Tea Party thing is that you can have this sort of loose organization of a lot of people, and they will get out people to events and stuff like that. What I think has been missing so far is a strong central concept. And the I use the analogy to businesses. Like, if you want a successful business now, like Starbucks is an idea. You know, Starbucks is a concept. It's like, it's sort of upscale coffee with that makes you feel good and affluent and creative going in there, right? And so, to me, that was a different... It's not just... Starbucks didn't just succeed because it's like, well, we have good coffee. It succeeded because it had this sort of meme that you could wrap your head around. And so to compete with that, you need to have a different meme, and nobody's come up with that. I think what the meme is, what's going to happen, the thing that's going to create a viable third party, is a reaction to what I'll call corruption on the both Democratic and Republican parties. And what you see with the Tea Party and with Obama is this growing sense among Democrats and Republicans, people who are traditionally Democrats and Republicans, going, you know what, this system sucks. The lobbyists have way too much power. The corporations have way too much power, which is actually something that you see on the in the Tea Party side as well.
Yeah, sure.
And I think, and again, this is complete conjecture, but I know what's going to happen with the media stuff. That's the tech stuff and the media stuff is easy to predict. That's
right.
That's going to happen. What's harder is what's the idea? And I think that if the idea were, look, the Democrats and the Republicans are both beholden to these huge moneyed interests that don't let anything get done. That's why we can't get immigration policy
right.
That makes sense. That's why we can't get a lot of, you know, you call yourself a common sense Democrat. A lot of this stuff is really, in a sense, common sense. I think a lot of people would agree, even on healthcare, like we need a healthcare infrastructure safety net that so people aren't, you know, we don't want people starving in America, but we don't want people dying of diseases when they just because they couldn't afford it. I think that there's some consensus on that, actually. But, of course, we can't get any of that stuff because of the corporations. So where I see the meme going is eventually there's a tipping point where a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans go, you know what? I don't trust my party anymore. But then it becomes a matter of what's the policy. And I tend to think that the liberal and conservative – look, like if we look at it in a big sense, I think capitalism and socialism, those words don't mean very much anymore. Because what is China? Are they socialist and communist? No. Are they capitalist? No. You know, what's the U.S.? And they're not even mixed economies. It's like this corporate – they are mixed, but it's like this corporate socialism. It's just capo socialism or something.
Right. But neither of them are models to emulate. I mean, China's sort of a corrupt kleptocratic capitalism.
No, that's right. And so to me, even the terms liberal and conservative, the way they're getting thrown around now, I'm one of those people who tends to think that the Tea Party, a lot of the people in that movement have diagnosed the problem in a vague sense correctly.
Right. But
they don't have a solution.
Right, right. The couple of things. I agree with you. A couple devil's advocate things. One, how do you get people elected at the local level? You know, that's really where the unions get their power. Is if you want to work your way up the ladder of the Democratic Party, starting at local city council. If the union is against you, you're not going to win. because they have the organization in place and the money, and they turn out the people, and it's very, very hard to beat them. So by the time you get to the top of the Democratic Party, like, running for governor, the unions basically own you, unless you're Jerry Brown, your father's famous. The second thing, and so even if we had a viable third-party movement, it would have a very tough time winning at the local level, even if it would win at the statewide and national level, maybe. The other thing is, of course, that they're coming up with procedural reforms that will have the effect of stopping it. This top two reform that Schwarzenegger is pushing, where the top two vote-getters go into the general election regardless of what party they were at, that might be good because you would think, you know, it'll departisanize elections but historically has been the death of third parties. If you look at the Oregon experience, if you're the Libertarian Party, you're never going to finish in the top two. And your whole leverage came that you were on the ballot in the general election. So you were a potential sort of troublemaker. And this gets rid of the troublemakers.
Well, on the tech side, so the reform stuff, I think ultimately it's sort of doomed to, ultimately that kind of thing I think is doomed to fail. The system definitely wants to keep itself in power. That's normal.
Right.
But I think the thing that's going to happen technically is where we're at in the internet now, the initial first big wave of internet stuff was stuff that made people nationally or internationally connect. So you get the rise of something like the Huffington Post or Slate or whatever. It's big national stuff that, you know, it's replacing, the Huffington Post, sort of replaces the New York Times, the Washington Post, or a big national paper, right? Mm-hmm. The next wave that we're starting to see now, and that you're going to continue to see, is the neighborhood web. And it's weird. This didn't happen first. It's happening second. Where if you wanted to start a newspaper, let's say, now, your smart play, actually, is not to try to compete at a national level, but it's to try to start, like, you live in Venice, like the Venice Times, you know, online,
right,
whatever, and
right,
to have it, even at a very micro level, this neighborhood in New York or this neighborhood in Albuquerque, and I think that that's where you're going to, so as the web tends to get more, and again, that hasn't quite happened yet, there's no real micro local news service where I am right now. But the reason that that's going to change is because it's very easy to go out and start that right now. Like, all you'd have to do to start it is you need a way to do mass mailings, like Constant Contact or MailChimp or any
right.
of those services which exist. Then you need somebody who can write and do the stories, and that's become very
right.
easy to do now. And so I think as you see the web get more local, which is I think the trend in the next 5 years, let's say, suddenly getting your local candidates is more viable technologically because you have a way to reach out to people. If you had the local Venice email list, basically, that's huge.
Right.
That's
a very good point.
And so I'm one of those, like, I kind of go, because I understand all the arguments again. Well, here's the thing, it's interesting. So you got about 100,000 votes in California, right?
Right. A little more, yeah.
So I looked at the other numbers, and again, these things are skewed because it's a primary and so on, but you got more votes than the Libertarian or Independent or Peace and Freedom candidates, the other third parties, all combined. So you, as the third place Democrat, got more votes than any of those all put together. So I think people look at that and they go, well, the third party has no chance. See, look, they don't get that many votes. But I think that the things that have made – I think the problem is the reason the Libertarians aren't ever going to get that many votes is because their agenda is wrong. And it's the same thing with Peace and Freedom and these other candidates. That people know, you know, people, they don't want what, they like parts of the libertarian thing, but they don't like other parts of it, and they're never going to like other parts of it. But
yeah, no, people want some sort of, it seems to me that, you know, the Pat Cadello is used to do polls of this, this fictional candidate, Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith would always beat the hell out of the conventional Democrat. And it turned out Mr. Smith was Gary Hart and the conventional Democrat was Walter Mondale. But right. Mr. Smith basically was a neoliberal, moderate Democrat, believed in the market, not placed in a certain amount of redistribution, but not that much, and wasn't beholden to union power, et cetera, et cetera. And was, you know, pretty moderate on foreign policy. And that's sort of, it seems to me, where the center of gravity is. The danger is it'll turn into moderate mush, but it's not libertarian, it's not peace and freedom.
Right. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, my thought was, you know, why do an independent? Why won't we just see the growth of, you know, personality-driven politics? So there'll be a Schwarzenegger party and a Sarah Palin party and a, you know, I don't know. And I guess the answer is, A, you have to be very charismatic to pull that off, and there wouldn't necessarily be a supply of charismatic people. And I guess I was hoping that a moderate party could get power just by being on the ballot in the general election. So what was a two-way race would be a three-way race, and the press would have to cover it as a three-way race. And, you know, even if a moderate party got only 10% of the vote, it would have incredible leverage in a close race. So you would get on the map that way. And the problem with that, of course, is it's sort of illegitimate. I mean, you really don't want third parties screwing around with the result and being like Ross Perot.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So it's relying on a flaw in the election laws to generate your power. And unfortunately, they're getting rid of that flaw.
Yeah, yeah.
It may be that even though that you could come with a party that, unlike the libertarians, appealed to people, that it was that won't work. But I don't know. That these are all the issues I'm wrestling with now.
And, yeah, right. You know, but it's interesting. I mean, you were in the race for a pretty short period of time, right? You filed.
It was a couple months, 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, which I think also is barely enough time to really register for a lot of people as a blip.
Right. No. Yes. No. It was a very, very short time, and I think we did a good job of getting press in the short period of time. We just didn't do a good job of getting support, or didn't do it. Yeah. You know, there wasn't. I guess my official line is there wasn't enough time.
Yeah.
We ran out of time. But so it's yes, it was a very short period of time, and a longer period of time might bear more fruit. A longer period of time with a different candidate might bear more fruit. I mean, I don't think I was necessarily the ideal candidate, but they're not, you know, the better candidates I can think of are all somehow locked into the status quo and wouldn't break away.
Well, I definitely think the immigration issue, for instance, like there was a story on Huffington Post today that I forget who it was. One of the cabinet secretaries came out and said, well, the idea of getting rid of birthright citizenship is just wrong. And, you know, Huffington Post, I mean, I read the comments there. I know how it runs. It's a lot more liberal than conservative in the comments. Conservatives do get in comment.
Right.
On that story, almost everyone was saying, well, she's not explaining why birthright citizenship is a good idea.
Right.
And so I think that, like, it's interesting, like, the topic of birthright citizenship or the 14th Amendment issue, I don't even see that being actually discussed in any way where people are kind of, like, I ask on Twitter, I have a lot of Twitter followers, I ask on Twitter, I'm like, can someone just explain to me why that's a good idea today?
Right, and a lot of countries have been driven to abandoning it. I have a very cynical view of this birthright citizenship issue, which is even though there's there are arguments on either side. It's almost entirely a cynical ploy by Lindsey Graham and John Kyle and John McCain to give themselves cover on the right that will allow them to sell out on the amnesty issue.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
It's so obvious to me that that's what Graham's think. You know, it used to be that I always thought that they could buy off the right just by building a fence, because the right was so cared so much about the fence. If you build the fence, they would accept amnesty for people who are here now. And this is sort of like that. This is, instead of building a fence, we will pretend we're getting rid of birthright citizenship, which will, you know, give us enough support on the right that their hope is that they can then sign on to some sort of deal that includes amnesty. I don't think it'll work, but that's clearly what Graham has in mind.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, I agree with that. Now that I think about it,
he practically said it. I mean, he's basically said it in so many words. Anyway, that's it's even better. It's even more cynical because they know the birthright citizenship thing isn't going to fly. In other words, they're going to propose an amendment. It's very hard to get a constitutional amendment through. It won't pass.
Right.
Or else they'll dicker with, court language, and it will lose in the courts. So they will sell the right down the river with this birthright thing while they sneak amnesty past them. That's, I think, what's going on.
Yeah, that's smart. Well, again, this has been great. I don't want you. I've kept you for a long time, and I don't.
No, this has been very useful for me.
Cool.
This whole thing about what's going to happen when people stop watching TV is very interesting. I haven't thought about that, but damn, if you look at what Meg Whitman is doing, it's all TV, right? So if you take that away from her, what does she do? How does she buy the election?
No, that's right, and that's yeah. I mean, my background is more tech than. I'm a person with political opinions, but my background's working for high tech companies.
Right.
And so I think about that stuff, and to me, like I say, it's not brain surgery to make the prediction. You know what's, and people will still watch video.
Right.
It'll just be in their pocket. You know.
Right.
It's getting to the point now. Like right now with the smartphones, they're really good media devices right now. They're great, and. And I like TV, and I watch very little TV. I like watch Mad Men,
right.
And about an hour of news. But I watch a lot of TV online, and I don't think I'm 45. I'm not like,
right.
I'm not like a young whippersnapper.
I guess the worry is that somehow with the end of net neutrality, they will figure out a way where to reach a lot of people. You have to have a lot of money.
Yeah, I just don't think. I think that the. Like I say, you know, there's a really good book that a guy, Seth Godin, wrote. He's a business writer, and he wrote Unleashing the Idea Virus. And some of my ideas on the political thing are sort of based on his thought that a strong enough idea now, a strong enough concept, replicates itself throughout the system very fast. And I think the problem is, and by strong enough idea, I don't even mean, I'm not talking like good policy. I'm just talking like a strong, like Sarah Palin, you know what you're getting there, lover or hater. She's identifiable the way Angelina Jolie or Starbucks or McDonald's is. She's a very clearly defined product. And I think the biggest problem is that no one's defined the product yet. And the thing that I look at from both the left and the right is I see a lot of people who are Democrats who are sick of the party and realize it's corrupt. And that change from within is probably impossible. And the same thing, I interviewed Ed Morrissey, who writes for Hot Air,
right.
The other day about the Tea Party. And a lot of the people on the left just make these assumptions about the Tea Party. Oh, it's all racist, blah, 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 blah. And they, they're lockstep Republicans. And Ed confirmed for me what I thought, which is they're not.
Right, no.
They're not lockstep Republicans. They're very skeptical of the Republican Party. But what Ed pointed out, and he's correct, is they tend to be small government people. And who's that? That's the Republicans. That's not the Democrats. So they don't tend to rally behind Democrats. But I think that there is – it's not about – to me, it's not about big or small government. It's about effective government. And if that case were being made, you know, smaller tends to be better. If you're trying to be efficient and effective, a smaller organization tends, that's better. You know, people know that. But and Obama was kind of making that case. In the general election campaign, he was just a very, very different candidate than he's been a president.
I think you could also, you can win some of them over by pointing out that there are big government institutions like Medicare, or, for example, the database in which we want to check,
right,
you know, immigrants to see if they're legal or not, where a big national presence can be relatively benign.
Yes.
And fair and treat people fairly and equally. And the real thing that the Tea Party resents is the big boys getting special favors by lobbyists. And,
right.
And you can say, well, you know, you can say, you can play on that without saying that, you know, big, that goes hand in hand with national institutions and, you know, like Medicare and the IRS, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a lot. I think there's a lot in the Tea Party for people to their, you know, who aren't Republicans to work with. I agree with that. It's like,
yeah,
it's like very similar to the George Wallace voters.
Right.
Bobby Kennedy got a whole bunch of them.
And the thing I notice is the people who, as soon as you sort of step outside the Democratic orthodoxy at all, right now. I mean, I get this because I'm friendly with Jane Hampshire too, and of course Jane was like, she and I talk about the same thing. Like, we get called Republicans, and she's not a Republican. She's not a Republican at all. But
no,
as soon as you sort of question the establishment, some people are very quick to jump out because you're a Republican.
Why do people call Jane a Republican?
She and I have very similar policy views, I guess, on stuff like she and I, neither one of us were happy about the health care bill at all.
Right.
We felt it was a big sellout to corporations.
Right.
And so it's the weirdest thing in the world that when you say, I think this bill's a sellout to corporations, and I could support it if it had a public option.
Right.
That someone would then scream Republican at you.
But also, Jane also said nice things about the Tea Parties, and sort of wasn't there the beginning of an outreach there by her?
Well, what it was is she there was one issue that involved Rahm Emanuel's corruption, I guess, that Grover Norquist was on as well. But, you know,
right,
you can't. I talked to her about it. Her take was, okay, you know, he's right on that issue. And
right,
if it's beneficial, I mean, she's doing stuff now on the Just Say Now, the marijuana legalization thing, where you're going to, look, if you're doing issue politics, it crosses party lines sometimes.
Right.
And her take was, you know, Grover's right on this issue.
Right.
If it helps get it out there, I'll do it. And people are like, well, why? You know, I had somebody the other night. I've been on the Glenn Beck show a couple of years ago, and people were like, "Well, why would you go on the Glenn Beck show?" And I'm like,
"'Cause
right, they invited me." I mean, they invited me, and I'm not going to go on and change my opinion.
Right.
So, but some people, it's this idea, and I think it's a very it's the way the establishment protects itself. If people got to talking and see that they have more in common across these party lines than they think, that's a real threat to both the Democratic and the Republican establishment.
Right. And I admire that instinct of Jane.
Yeah, no, you know, and I think it was just smart. But, I mean, you know, again, I mean, I see it with you, too. I was looking at some of the comments in one of your videos, and people were like, well, you know, you might as well be a Republican. And I'm like, I don't see that, but okay.
Yeah, it's a hard argument to make. I mean, my basic argument is, you know, I'm against the institutional power, increasing the institutional power of labor unions, and I'm against an amnesty until we secure the borders, and, you know, but yet I'm a Democrat, and I think those are consonant with Democratic goals, and if you really believe in Democratic goals, those are the positions you should have. And I can make that argument intellectually. It's harder to make that in a campaign on the grounds that most of the people who agree with me on those two issues are Republicans.
Right.
Already.
Yeah.
So in a Democratic primary, you're not going to get their votes. And that was the tough row I had to hoe, and why, even if you started a third party, this is another issue I'm wrestling with, even if you started a third party or had an independent candidate, I think you might have to pick one of those issues or the other. In other words, starting with both of them, the people who are against the excessive institutional power of labor unions aren't really going to be, and who are Democrats, are not going to be also skeptical of amnesty.
Well, I'll tell you, the thought I've had is, again, it all flows from what the central core idea of this third party is. Like libertarians, for instance, clear, again, they're a good party in the sense that they have a clear idea. Your people are opposed to it or in favor of it, but it's clear. We want as small a state as possible,
right.
Possibly none. That's a clear idea. So my idea is if you took corruption out of the system, if the idea behind this party is we're the not corrupt party.
Right.
So then you ask yourself, you just go down the line on issues and go, does that affect issues? And I think the answer is yeah. So I think you end up at a place. I think the problem now is people want to, I guess when I say the Libertarian Party is good, what I really mean is they have a consistency and a coherency that people can wrap their brain around. Okay, I get what they're in favor of. I might not want to vote for it, but I get it. So if the coherency of this new party is we want to take the corrupting power of money out of politics, and then you say, well, how would that affect issues? Then I think you'd go, well, we don't want business to have big money influence on this party, and we don't want the unions to have big money influence in this party. Suddenly you've got a coherent position. That's like, oh, okay, I get that. And I think people are in favor of that. And I think even people who view themselves right now as Democrats or Republicans might get into that. And it's the same thing with immigration. You go, okay, well, like, look, one of the solutions on immigration is we need to have enforcement of businesses who hire illegals. And it's been hard to get that through because businesses don't want that and they have too much influence. So if you just start going through issues, suddenly you come up with this actual third alternative. It's not really Democratic. It's not really Republican. But it is coherent. And then it's a matter of I use the term marketing, but, you know, not in terms of lying, which a lot of marketing is, but just explaining it properly. You know, here's what we're in favor of.
Right.
But no one's kind of come up with that yet. There's no there right now. But if you start with how sick everybody is of the corrupt system, I think you could get people to go, oh, you're against that? Okay, sign me up.
I think there's something to that. I have to think about it. If you had this, you know, we're not the corrupt guys, how much of a healthcare policy could you generate from that in a bunch of widely accepted values like that we're not going to let people die just because they're poor?
Right.
I don't know how you might get pretty far. I agree, but
you can't point to anybody who's taking that line. You see, this is not, I'm sort of coming at this conceptually, but I agree, you know, there's other things that are obviously important, like you do need you need actual candidates and stuff. But I'm like, well, if that's the concept, right, could you get a set of coherent positions out of it? And the more I think about it, the more I go, you know what, you could. It's not a hodgepodge of anti-ideas.
You wouldn't get a position on the Afghan war, for example.
I could argue that you would, because I would say if you look at the power that weapons companies have, or Halliburton, or those sorts of things, one of the ways we get into these wars that drag on for a long time and seem to have no point is that they profit a Halliburton or you know, whoever, the arms companies. And again, I think that it's one of those things where, like I say, you know, again, it's weirdly not an extremist view. I think it's sort of a common sense view, which is, you know, should we have done something after 9/11? Yes. I think most people would agree with that. Has it gone on way too long? Yes. I think most people would agree with that. But they don't get, I think that, see, a lot of my thoughts on this, too, were the stuff Larry Lessing has done, Professor Larry Lessing has done, talking about corruption. And I really thought Obama might be, like, because he was talking a good game, might be an antidote for that. And now I see that that's just not possible from the Democratic Party, I don't think, because they need the money. So then you ask yourself, why do they need the money? And it's like, oh, the reason they need the money is because they're buying all this old media.
Right. That's basically true.
And then, so then what happens is if you don't need, if you're going on the basis of, my other theory that relates to marketing is that the Democrats and the Republicans have succeeded despite having a lousy product. In other words, if Starbucks had really bad coffee, like if their coffee sucked,
right,
then you'd kind of go, wow, that's a complete triumph of marketing.
Like,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they've succeeded largely because they've had a lousy product. Well, in the business marketplace, the way you'd take over is you'd have a good product, and then you'd market it right. And so that's why I kind of think, like, the good product is the non-corrupt one. And also, to me, it still hits on all the points that people like about it's pro-American.
Right.
It's the thing,
I guess. Go ahead.
No, it's just, you know, it's just you. It definitely has that thing of, like, this is what the country was founded on, that every political party wants to have. Every political party wants Jefferson on their side, you know.
Right. I guess it'd be interesting to see what were the parties like before the rise of the mass media.
Yes.
Before their basic function was to extract money from people and to put ads on TV. Were they more fractious? Were they less entrenched? Did they, you know, did parties rise and fall more rapidly? I think they did, but I'd be interested in seeing what they were like, because we're going back a little to that world.
Well, yeah, where we're going, it's interesting, though, because I've thought about that, too. It's interesting. What it was like was it was all local. It was really local. And so I think it widely varied depending upon where you were, where the political, the Tammany Hall sort of thing, but it wasn't national. It was like, okay, we have that in this city, but other cities it might be better, you know?
Right.
But now what we've got is this technology that allows one person to reach everybody in the world.
Right.
And so, you know, you or I writing or putting up a blog or putting up a video or whatever, it can reach literally almost everybody in the world,
right,
and certainly everybody in the country.
Right.
That's never happened before. And
right.
And so it, but, you know, that's like necessary but not sufficient to get
right.
to get a new political movement going.
Right. And
go ahead.
But that's the solvent even of the old Tammany Hall style machines, pre-TV machines.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Good point.
So, yeah, so it's like I say, I mean, I see it sort of increasingly, and I see all these data points that show me that there's, that the, like, the recent flare-up over the Gibbs comments and stuff like that, a lot of people on the left are really sick of this administration already. And so it's like, and for reasons that I think are valid to be sick of it, that if they, you know, they're not even, Bush at least sort of played to the base a little bit.
I'm not sick of it. I think, you know, we can always add a public option later, but maybe I'm, you know, an Obama Mooney. But it just seems to me he's accomplished quite a bit. Unfortunately, the one thing he hasn't accomplished is getting the unemployment rate down.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, I think that also a lot of the accomplishments have been watered down where it's not what he ran on, basically. And so,
yeah, they've been watered down a lot, but it's quite, like with the Wall Street regulations, it's still better than nothing, I think. Yes, healthcare is still better than nothing, yes. So, you know, bailouts, still better than no bailouts? Yes. I mean, the auto industry bailout.
Right, yeah. Well,
they've all been screwed up, but...
That requires a kind of... what you're saying, though, requires a kind of political nuance that I think a lot of Obama voters didn't have. I think they expected bigger things, and because he promised bigger things.
Right, well, he yeah.
And I think a lot of... So I think a lot of the casual voters just are like, okay, well, I'm not that interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the problem he's going to have in 12 is getting people out. And I think that having lost the independents, he's going to lose. He's lost the independents, and he's lost the casual voters, and he's lost some of the people on the left. And so,
well, right, but
and I don't think there's enough centrist Democrats to who like his accomplishments to get him elected again. Depends who he runs against.
It is 2 years when we, you know, Clinton, this is Clinton in 94. He has 2 years to show that he's better than the crazy Republicans who've taken over Congress.
Yeah, right, right.
And I think that's going to happen. So, I think he'll be looking a lot better in 2012. But yes, in the meantime, he's in big trouble.
Yeah,
these things are suggestive of some sort of fractioning of our politics. This is all really interesting. I have to think about all this stuff.
Yeah, okay. Hey, well, Mickey, it was really great talking to you. This is great.
Thank you. And you're in Albuquerque now?
Yeah, a little south of Albuquerque, but yeah. It's
cool.
It's nice. But I get into LA, so
Well, look me up. We'll have coffee and overpriced coffee in my overpriced neighborhood.
Okay, that's great. Mickey Kaus, everyone, and thanks a lot, Mickey.
Thanks, Lee.
Bye.